Welcome back to another episode of the Neuro Experience Podcast. I'm Louisa, I'm the host. This episode is all about becoming stress-proof. Neuroscientist, researcher, and guest on this week's episode, Dr. Meetu Storoni, has read over 1,000 academic papers to answer the question, what is stress? And team, it turns out that although you can't see it, stress is everywhere. Once pushed aside as something that couldn't be explained, stress is now quantifiable, identifiable. It's a solid thing that has a real physical effect on our body and our long-term health. But what can we do about it? Meetu shares the findings of her research and explains just what stress can do to our bodies and how we can measure it using modern technology. She gives some brilliant practical tips on how we can buffer ourselves from the consequences of stress. She reveals the alarming link between stress and insulin resistance. Here's what she says.
The moment we become acutely stressed, we become insulin resistant. In a sense, it's the brain anticipating an adaptation gap between the state of ourselves at this moment and what it is about to encounter.
I hope you guys enjoy this episode. If you do, please go through and leave us a review. Welcome to the Neuro Experience Podcast, where you will learn the science of human performance and optimization. There is a product out there people are calling nature's superfuel in a bottle, the fourth macronutrient, and the Times even called it the drink of dreams. The Atlantic quoted it as the most incredible surge of positive energy. It's better than caffeine. It's better than sugar. I want to introduce you to the world's best kept secret. It's called Ketone IQ. Ketone IQ delivers a clean, focused boost of energy. It's a competitive edge for your brain and body, and you will thank me later. It's clinically proven to boost mental clarity, endurance, recovery, and more. If you've heard some of the podcast episodes before, you'll hear me speaking of Ketone IQ, especially in when it comes to athletic performance, brain endurance, and healing the brain from a traumatic injury. If you want to check this out, you guys can get 10% off when you order your next batch of Ketone IQ from HVMN. Just go to ketone-iq.com, use promo code NEURO at checkout. That is promo code NEURO at checkout. I'll link it all below in the show notes. I am beyond excited to have you for several reasons. One, because of your background in medicine as an eye surgeon, and then also I'm really excited to delve deeper into your book. So why don't we start with a brief background on your academic background, your work, what you're interested in that led you to where you are today?
Thank you. So my background is I trained in medicine. So I went for a medical course. During my medical training, I was exposed to a lot of neuroscience research. I also did specialize in neuroscience. You could do that as a kind of an intercalated degree when I went into medical school. Then I was exposed to even more research during then. And then for my elective, I spent a couple of months in the lab of a very famous neuroscientist who's now sadly passed away, David Hubel. And I think that's when I really got interested in the visual cortex. And then when I finished my medical training, I thought, how do I bring these two together? So I, after specializing in ophthalmology, doing training in ophthalmology, I also did a PhD in neuro-ophthalmology, which is studying the neurology behind any eye disorder. And also it's a kind of a top-down route to the eyes. Mm. But also any neurological disorder that affects the brain will inevitably affect the visual pathways because they are so broad, they're so widespread. And then finally, so that was my interest in the brain. and vision and the brain. And I did various facets of that. So for instance, I did a lot of experiments on pupillometry, and I looked at a condition called neuromyelitis optica, which is a very close relative of multiple sclerosis. And through all of that, I was very exposed to the elephant in the room, which is something, a great big unknown, which always was somehow playing a role in exacerbating multiple sclerosis relapses in some patients, and in various other facets of eye diseases as well. It was always an elephant in the room, because when I was at medical school, when we did our medical training, stress was never a subject that was formally studied. We knew about it. It was very hard to quantify it. So it was quite literally an elephant in the room. And then, of course, being on the other side, I was exposed to a lot of stress during my training, during my specialization. So I became very interested in stress. And then I changed geolocation. I moved to Hong Kong from London. And it's a very, very fast city, very, very busy, very globalized. No one lives and works to Hong Kong hours. Everyone's circadian rhythm is tied to New York rather than Hong Kong, I would say. And many, many people have stress-related disorders. So I was very exposed to this burden of stress, and that's when I grew very interested. And I went through a lot of literature, and I thought, wow, there's so much in there that actually I didn't know about myself. So why not turn this into a book? And that's how I wrote Stress Proof.
Oh, wow. That is so interesting. I love that you went through this journey. When you were talking about NMO or NMOSD, I should say,
correct.
It reminded me, we were talking offline, and I was mentioning that I'm currently doing board certification in intraoperative neuromonitoring. And we did a patient simulation 2 weeks ago, and the patient, she had NMOSD, neuromyelitis spectrum disorder. And so when you're talking about it, and it was pretty much, I gave like a 1,000 word essay on it, so it's still fresh in my mind. And it is crazy, like, what somebody experiences. And the fact that you're now like talking about stress, the eye, the brain, I'm so interested in this, because I think, and you can probably talk more about this, but do you think that we've got the wrong idea in society of what stress is?
I think you're right. I think we do, to an extent. First of all, the definition of stress is very blurry when we use it in a general way. Many people use the word stress to describe acute emotional distress in a situation. But in physiology and in medicine, well, in physiology and more importantly, a stress reaction is one where there is evidence of activation of a very specific hormonal pathway, which we call the HPA axis pathway. And I think that we very often use the term stress to describe feeling a certain way even before the HPA axis has been activated. So for instance, if there's a lot of noradrenergic activity, if we're in a state of high arousal, we sometimes use the word stress for it. So that's one angle of what you say. The other angle is that, and I think this is more of an important angle, is we assume when we use the word stress that it refers to psychological distress in the moment. And we forget that actually the physiology of stress, so when you actually have a stress reaction, you have at least 7 pathways being triggered inside the body, starting at the point of the brain. And we very often forget or aren't aware that many of these pathways are actually stress-related. So just very quickly to give you a couple of examples, the moment we become acutely stressed, we become insulin resistant. Our inflammatory markers in the blood shoot up temporarily.
Is this the first stage?
This is the first stage. So I mean, okay. Just a step back from that. If you imagine the context within which we evolved to have a stress response, which is an evolved mechanism that has saved our lives, it's a survival mechanism. In a sense, it's the brain anticipating an adaptation gap between the state of ourselves at this moment and what it is about to encounter. And this gap may be bioenergetic. So does the brain and body have enough fuel to survive this? And there are also other facets amongst it, but very basically it's an adaptation gap. And if we delve a little bit into a specific context that has helped hone this stress response, it is essentially running away from a predator. So if you've been attacked by a predator and you are bleeding and you have a long way to outrun whichever animal is chasing after you, then what do you do? So you need, first of all, you need to really run very fast. You need the burst of energy. Adrenaline and cortisol specifically, we call them glucocorticoid. Why? Because they increase the level of sugar in the blood. Okay, they give you more energy. Adrenaline increases the pace, increases the acceleration and the intensity of all your physiology, increases the intensity at which your heart is pumping blood, the rate at which your heart is pumping blood. So it has these chronotropic and inotropic effects. And then you have the rest of the arms, the other remaining arms of the stress response. So you have insulin resistance, which temporarily prevents your muscle and liver from sucking up the sugar in the blood so that there's more left for the brain. Because ultimately, you want your brain to survive. If your brain dies, you die. Mm. And then we have other facets. So if you're running with a gaping wound, you don't want to survive that run, but then die from an infection. So you want there to be some kind of an immune reaction, some kind of inflammation that protects you against any pathogen that's entering through your open gaping wounds. So these are the various contexts within which we have evolved to have a stress response. And that's why, just to summarize again very quickly, the moment you become acutely stressed, at least 7 processes take place in the body. There are more, but these 7 are things that are actionable. First.
And this is the ones outlined in your book, Stress Proof, the 7 pathways. Yes.
In the book. So you have an autonomic, so very briefly to summarize them, you have an autonomic reaction, which most people will be very aware about. The fight or flight response is how we usually describe it. When the seesaw of your autonomic nervous system tilts away from parasympathetic activity towards more sympathetic activity, your blood pressure rises, heart rate rises, and so on. Then that's followed very quickly by this cascade of hormones starting up at the hypothalamus. So that's when your HPA axis, a trio of organs, become active. So your autonomic response is your electric response. Your HPA axis response is your hormonal response. And that's where we talk about adrenaline followed by cortisol. Cortisol actually peaks about 20 to 30 minutes after the initial spike in the stress response. And cortisol actually has, some people believe, and some researchers think, it has an evolved function to actually quieten down the inflammation after it's been triggered. So in a very healthy stress response, you should get a spike of inflammation, and then the cortisol spikes about 20, 30 minutes after, and that dampens down the inflammation. And you'll be aware of this because we normally use corticosteroids, steroid therapy, for inflammatory conditions, asthma, eczema, and so on. So those are the hormonal electrical.
I want to just understand this as we go through the 7 pathways. I always do a patient X. So let's describe one event that might happen, because when you talk about stress, the brain, and is this true, the brain really can't differentiate between if you're going through an emotional stress, that of maybe a divorce, let's just say, or the stress of maybe being hit by a car. The brain just says, stress. Okay. So let's just say you are in this patient X profile, they're going through something very traumatic emotionally. Okay. And we'll use that as the event. Okay. They finally, they at stage one, they hit, you know, it hits them. Oh my gosh. He wants a divorce. Okay. Then this is the first thing that starts. So it's the autonomic reaction. That's the first pathway that starts. Okay.
Correct. The autonomic reaction going triggered really by your emotional response to the situation, even before you're conscious of it, fully conscious, okay. Before you have full conscious control over it. So yes, autonomic response is the first start. And then in parallel with that comes a surge in inflammation. So emotional stress in itself alone makes your inflammatory markers in the blood surge. And these are measurable. You also become temporarily insulin resistant. I mean, a really interesting example is there was a study done on bungee jumpers who, as soon as they completed their bungee jump, they all had blood sugar spikes. They were all temporarily insulin resistant. So insulin resistance. And then you have this surge of motivation, which I think most people will be aware of. The evolved reason is if you're running away from a lion, you don't really want to say, oh, well, you know, I really can't be asked. I'll just take a little nap. You don't want to do that. You want to keep the drive going. So in an acute response, so when you hear this bad news, whatever you're doing, your motivation momentarily surges. Now, it's very important that I'm talking about the very, very acute situation. Because as soon as you keep these various buttons pressed, so for instance, if you're going through a divorce, the situation isn't over 5 minutes later. The situation is there and it persists and you get no respite from it. And that is really the key, because that's where acute stress turns into chronic stress. And as soon as that happens, as in many parts of our physiology, the effects of single pathways are not linear. They become unpredictable and non-linear. So a short bout, as an example, short bout of cortisol, it has an anti-inflammatory effect. But if you keep the button pressed and you have a high baseline of cortisol that doesn't stop, then the anti-inflammatory effect is gone. And if you have further perturbations with a high baseline of cortisol, you start having pro-inflammatory effects. Similarly, that very moment after you hear the bad news, you do get a surge in motivation. But if you keep that bad news pedal pressed, so you keep the chronic stress response going, your surge in motivation actually turns into the opposite. You lose motivation and your motivation sinks lower than your baseline.
During that motivation stage, is that where you see an increase in the secretion of dopamine?
You can see an increase in the secretion of dopamine, but just to be very clear, all of these neurotransmitters that are at play, noradrenaline, dopamine, and of course the systemic effects of these feedback. So any adrenaline that's being released by your adrenal glands talks to your brain. So you have these huge circular pathways that are very, very active. So I personally would say that it's really a very complex system response. It's not a single neurotransmitter whose change or whose surge can be perfectly tallied to each one of these effects. So these are all a combination. I mean, cortisol itself has effects. So all of these are a kind of a meshwork of outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so, then what happens next?
So I'm going to just give you another angle to this. A really great example, which I'm sure you see in the corporate world, I've certainly seen in the corporate world, is when people are in a state of chronic stress for a long, long time, especially if they get to a stage where there really is no respite, you will find people needing more and more to raise their sense of reward, raise their sense of joy compared to their baseline. And that is one of the things that is a red flag for the presence of chronic stress. So people who would be very happy with what they have, if they stay in a state of chronic stress for a long time, you'll find that suddenly the things that have always made them happy are no longer attractive, are no longer bringing them joy. And they start discarding those and seeking other ways to increase the sense of reward and joy. Because when I describe motivation, I'm really broadly describing the reward pathways, which involve liking, wanting, both of these things. And both of these go awry in the situation where your stress pedal is kept pressed.
So is this kind of like when I see, you know, like I work on Wall Street and I see a lot of people who are working in the hedge fund space. Their salary is around, you know, between 10 to 30 million and they do crazy things. And it might be on the weekends, you know, taking drugs, for example, just to, you know, party drugs, just to really find that happy spot. Or some of them are doing really crazy things. Like I have one client who one day he's in New York, the next day he's taken a private jet to an island just because he was just like, you know what, I just had to get away for the weekend. But it's like really, really over the top, crazy moves like that. So is that what you're referring to?
I mean, I'm reluctant to give you a single cause for an individual, but definitely the tendency to need more to achieve the same baseline of joy and pleasure and satisfaction as a person received before chronic stress. So this kind of gradual increase is certainly something that can be correlated with the state of losing the ability to feel pleasure at your normal baseline, for sure.
Wow. Okay.
So we talked about motivation. So we're talking about non-linear effects. I guess another angle to be very aware of is, and again, this is probably something that we are very gradually discovering, which is that the global burden of hypertension, having a high blood pressure, is rising. And we've known for a long time that chronic stress, I mean, before we actually, you know, really zoomed in on the pathology of chronic stress and the definitions and the biomarkers, we've known intuitively that people in stressful jobs, especially so-called white collar stressful jobs in the past, but generally mentally stressful jobs, tend to have a higher incidence or higher risk of heart disease, high blood pressure, dying early of heart attacks, and so on. And we've known this intuitively. Anyone of our generation, generations before us, will know this. But of course, now we are realizing that in a state of chronic stress, this seesaw of the autonomic nervous system that we spoke of, where one side, it actually has three arms, so we're just focusing on two, sympathetic and parasympathetic. One side, the sympathetic arm, is the fight or flight response, very vaguely described. The other side is the rest and digest, the calming down response. So normally we have a balanced seesaw where it's sometimes during the day we need one end pushed a little bit higher, a little bit more, and then it rebalances itself. So the ability to rebalance itself and flatten the seesaw kind of disappears if you carry on being in a state of chronic stress, such that your seesaw remains permanently tilted towards excessive sympathetic or fight or flight activity and not enough of a push in the other direction. So you always stay with a raised sympathetic activity baseline. And we now correlate this with things like hypertension, because if your sympathetic activity is higher, the pressure of your around your blood vessels will be raised, your heart will be pumping faster and more forcefully. So we're now suspecting that is this global rising burden of hypertension, high blood pressure, related to the global rising burden of urbanization and hence chronic stress? And remember, we spoke about inflammation. We talked about how there's a surge of inflammatory markers the moment you become acutely stressed. Now, in a healthy stress response, that surge will calm down. The cortisol surge at 20 to 30 minutes will help calm it down. However, if you stay chronically stressed, your inflammatory markers are no longer calming down. So you stay in a state of subclinical, because you will often not realize that you are in a state of inflammation. So subclinical chronic inflammation. And we now know that chronic inflammation is tied to a whole array of disease, not least including cardiovascular illness, such as atherosclerosis. And of course, another angle to excessive sympathetic activity is what we know as the effect on heart rate variability, which I'm sure most of your listeners will be very familiar with. So very broadly, heart rate variability is how good your heart is at suddenly adapting to novelty. So if you rise from a nap on the sofa in the afternoon, your heart has to suddenly beat faster to cope with the increased demand of gravity pulling down, of you being more active, and so on. And it has to very quickly do that and then stabilize. Similarly, if you're standing up and you lie down, it has to very quickly adapt to the fact that you're lying down and not beat excessively, and so on. So that ability to adapt is heart rate variability. And that is conferred by the autonomic nervous system. And we know that raised sympathetic activity actually reduces your ability, the ability of your heart to adapt to sudden change. And there is now quite a lot of data that shows that if you have low heart rate variability, you're more likely to develop arrhythmias. Of course, other factors have to play a part. But in stressful situations, you're more likely to develop arrhythmias, you're more likely to develop various pathologies in the heart stemming from the inability for your heart to adapt to demands on a moment-to-moment, instant-to-instant basis. And that we can now also correlate to chronic stress.
So chronic stress is definitely, the inflammatory pathways are definitely the precursors to many diseases, like you said, not just cardiovascular disease, certain types of cancer, neurodegenerative diseases. So what can one do then? Because, you know, it's all now, we're seeing in society, it's all about how can you stress relieve through things such as meditation, ice baths. But I think that they're really hard to come by. It's something that you have to go and actually seek out. What about if you are a working professional or you're a mother of three and you need to spend time to, you know, really activate the parasympathetic system, you know, so you're not too much sympathetic dominant? What have you seen that you can do on a daily basis? And should it be a daily basis? Should we be doing, you know, 10 to 15 minutes of, I don't know, stress relief each day?
So I think the really important message, which I'm not sure is made quite as clear as it could be in a very general way, is that chronic stress is not an illness. It's an adaptive change. And by that, what I mean is your brain is constantly calibrating itself to adapt to whatever is demanded of it. And the state of stress is a state change. It's not a pathological change. It's not caused by a disease. It's caused by a response to what the brain thinks is asked of it. So deviating a little bit, we know, for instance, that chronic stress is tightly correlated to thinning in parts of the brain, especially in parts of the prefrontal cortex, which is the higher brain that we use for decision-making and so on. And this has been correlated to a reduction in cognitive performance. Now, why does this change happen? It doesn't happen because the brain suddenly grows ill from stress. That is one way of looking at it. But perhaps a more sensible way of looking at it is the brain kind of lets go of whatever is not demanded of it. So if you're in a combat situation, as an example, and you have to be extremely vigilant, looking for threats, reacting on the instant, you don't have any forethought, you can't contemplate, you're not thinking like you would normally do when planning a chess move, you have to respond, you have to react immediately. At that moment, all the areas in the brain that are responsible for higher complex thinking become redundant. And if they stay redundant constantly, consistently over time, then the brain will visibly or measurably change its functional connectivity, and then after that, its structural connectivity. So chronic stress is in a sense a state change. So coming back to your question, if it were a disease like a viral infection or something, you could just take, or bacterial infection specifically, take an antibiotic, get rid of the disease, you're okay. But this is not what chronic stress is. It's an adaptive change. So in order to really protect yourself, protect your brain from the effect of chronic stress, whether, as you say, you're getting it from work, whether you're getting it from life in general, is to give your brain cues that stimulate it in a way to prevent the brain from adapting and staying in a state of reactivity. So what do I mean by that? First of all, yes, you do need short bouts of vagal stimulation, of activities that increase vagal activity, parasympathetic activity. Of course, these are all important. But I think the first thing to remember is what makes acute stress chronic. Remember, acute stress is not harmful. It becomes harmful if it becomes chronic. So acute stress, if it is too frequent, if you don't recover from it, or if it is too intense, these are some situations that turn acute stress into chronic stress. So if you're going through a divorce, you have the stressor consistently around you, get no respite. So one way to break that is to have segments of the day where you have such deep distraction or such deep immersion in an activity that makes you forget about what you're going through. If you can do that regularly through your day, every single day, that in itself acts like a break, prevents your acute stress from turning into chronic stress. And there is data that shows that people who suffer from work exhaustion, if during their evenings off or weekends off, rather than just relaxing, if they take part in a really engrossing activity where their minds are completely distracted and they don't think about what they're going through, that results in a better baseline the following day and overall moving forward. And one of the reasons for this, which is really critical, is that the stress response, the psychological stress response that we have, is a result of perceived stress. So your perception of a situation is what pushes the buttons. Unfortunately, in our urban worlds, psychological stress is the main stressor that we have, and that is brought about by your psychological perception of the reality around you. So if in your mind you're going through your day and you have this constant stressor, your brain will keep pressing on the stress button. But this gives you a tool, because if you can perceive an absence of that stress during a fragment of your day regularly, or regular fragments throughout the day, then that in itself cuts that chronic stress response short. I mentioned one thing in my book, which I find very useful personally as well, which is that if you go through a really intense stress response, the best thing you can do afterwards, and a real life situation, is, for instance, you are at work and you walk into your manager's office and you get some bad news, or you get a very, you know, you have some kind of very bad argument, and that leaves you really, really rattled. So normally you might think that, okay, after that you come back to your chair, you take a breather. You just think, okay, just going to have some 5 minutes, 10 minutes, take a breather. But actually, that is counterintuitive. The best thing you can do after a stressful response is do something so intense that your brain has registered that that previous episode is over.
So one of these cues, could that be, for example, going for a run or doing something, some form of high intensity activity?
Absolutely. It can be doing so. I'd add a little word of caution with high intensity activity, because there is data that shows that if you lift very heavy weights or you tax your heart when you're in a state of high emotional arousal, that can increase the risk of heart attack. So I generally don't advise going and doing a very intense session at the gym. But anything else that completely absorbs your mind, it doesn't even have to be physical, is very effective. If you think about it from your brain's point of view, okay, when you're in that office, your brain registers you're having a stressful reaction. It registers this is bad and it reacts. Now, when you leave that office, you know you've left the office. Your manager knows it's you've left the office. But does your brain know you've left the office? No, it does not. Your brain will replay the episode time and time again. And when the memory is fresh, if your brain replays it, it thinks the episode is still continuing. So rather than have 5 minutes of stress, your stressful episode will last for as long as you ruminate about it. So at that point, if you can do something that distracts you so completely that your mind cannot think about what happened, and it doesn't have to be physical, it can also be something mental. You can read something, you can play a game, you can talk to someone about something completely different. But that distraction presses the pause button. So your brain registers that that episode is over. And as soon as it does that, and this is so interesting because your physiology measurably reacts in this way. I mean, the study I mentioned relating to this took two bunches of people. They did the TSST, the Trier Social Stress Test, which is a psychological test done in experimental settings. So it put two groups of people through intense psychological stress. And then one group were allowed to just relax on the sofa. The other group had to do some intense activity. Then they measured the blood pressure of the two groups, because of course your blood pressure rises when you're in a state of stress. It will go down again when you've relaxed. And they found that rather than relax faster, the blood pressure of the group who went and sat on a sofa actually declined far more slowly. So It has a measurable effect on your stress response. So this is why, although perceived stress is the primary driver of the psychosocial stress we experience in our urban worlds, you can play with it. And if the brain is the source, you can trick it and you can play with it so that you curtail this perception of stress by distracting your brain, your mind immediately. And regarding your question earlier, you can extend this to your day-to-day life. So when you come back from work every evening, do something extremely absorbing that just puts a stop to all your ruminative thoughts throughout the day. And rumination is, of course, a big player in this. So this is one way in which you can do, in which you can kind of stop acute stress from becoming chronic stress.
I see. For me, I am a ruminator. Like I will, if something bothers me, I sit on it and I sit and I'll sit and I'll just keep going. And it ends up leading to stress and exhaustion.
So absolutely. So rumination is one of the, you know, the old saying, an empty mind is a devil's workshop. So yeah. There is a real interesting dissociation between mental fatigue, for instance, and physical fatigue. So if your muscle gets tired out, you rest it. But if your mind gets tired out from psychological stress, you must do anything but rest it. If you rest it, it will dwell. And if it dwells, the cues that it perceives will be prolonged and it will continue pressing the stress button.
I have to find a mentally stimulating activity other than watching Friends. Sometimes I put Friends on because it makes me laugh and it reminds me of when it used to be on when I was younger.
I used to love Friends too. I mean, Friends is a great option. But if you're at work, you can't really access Friends, at least legally anyway. Then you know there are others. I mean, there are some really good data on phone games, so handheld games you can play on your handheld phone. So, for instance, there's data on Tetris, And this data even relates to recovery after a traumatic experience. So for instance, the tendency to ruminate, again, it's an evolved tendency. It's not a bad tendency because your brain wants to solve problems. If it has gone through a stressful experience, it wants to replay it and learn from it and find out, dissect it to its minutiae to understand what it could have done to not make it happen and what it can do to not make it happen in the future. So the rumination is very normal, very understandable aspect of our evolved physiology. But because we now live in a world that's driven by our imagination, rumination has become more harmful, does more harm rather than good. So one way in which rumination, it plays a role, it's not the only thing, is if you have a very stressful experience that is intense enough to cause PTSD, many people will suffer from flashbacks. And these flashbacks are uncontrollable. You can't control them. But there is some data on how if you can distract yourself enough during the day, perhaps by avoiding rumination, by playing Tetris of all games. I think there's no more patent on Tetris, so I can just talk about it. I think it's a free game. You can get it on your phone. It's a very popular game, very old game. It actually was around before Friends, so it's a super.
God, I haven't played Tetris in years.
In years, so I have it on my phone ever since I saw the data. But if you play Tetris, for instance, there is data that shows that playing it at regular intervals can actually dampen down these flashbacks and enhance recovery after a traumatic experience. So that's how powerful tricking the mind is. Now, when I say this, some people argue that yes, but isn't distraction just a temporary band-aid, temporary plaster? And it absolutely is. But one way of looking at it is, if you have a cut, yes, you have to apply band-aid. And then let the cut heal. And it's a very similar process. So when you go through a stressful experience, your band-aid is the distraction. Once you've brought your stress physiological responses down, then your mind can process it, your brain can process it. You can write about it, you can think about it, you can talk about it, you can carry out active coping. Then you can resolve and move on from that stress response.
So this is so fascinating. As soon as we finish this, I'm going to go and download Tetris. You're doing a lot of work with different populations now. So you don't practice medicine per se anymore in a patient setting. You're more so now acting as a consultant, and you work with sporting teams, correct?
I work with a whole variety of populations, yes.
And so when you work with the athlete, for example, what are you working on? Is it stress? Is it mental performance? Is it confidence? What type of work do you do with them?
Well, all three are actually quite tied together.
Yeah.
I think that the most important aspect with athletes is, again, it depends on the level that they're playing at and so on, which makes a huge difference, because you always, people with the highest resilience factors often filter through to the highest level. So you have to take that into account. But I think the important thing with physical sport is physical activity is indeed a stressor. But one of the things to remember is that physical stress and psychological stress actually have a very interesting interplay. So we know, we mentioned earlier that you rest the muscle to recover physically, but you never rest the mind. When it comes to an athlete, you have to rest the muscle, and sometimes the athlete is too exhausted to not rest the mind. So you have a very interesting interplay there. But I think with sport, you have people within the sporting world, so athletes, will have some advantages already, because in sport, we tend to measure their physiological variables much more than in, say, a corporate population or knowledge worker population. Athletes are also far more aware of their physiology and their physiological response than a knowledge worker population. So in many ways, I personally find that aided by these two aspects, athletes are easier to understand in terms of stress response and stress management. When it comes to performance, it's a very different playing field, because when it comes to mental performance, we know that mental performance is correlated to physical performance. We know there's a big link between mental fatigue and physical fatigue in the absence of actual measurable reasons for physical fatigue. So these are things that need to be addressed. But I think that in a very general way, the knowledge worker population who sit at their desks and only use their brain are far more likely to carry a high burden of psychosocial stress. And because it's such a high burden, and because the physical buffer for psychosocial stress, namely physical fitness, active coping, physical activity, there are some of the buffers are absent, it is sometimes harder to address the chronic stress burden in a knowledge worker population. Athletes know about discipline, they know about diet, they know about sleep, hygiene. These are all scientifically proven to act as stress buffers, specifically psychological stress buffers.
Mm. So what's your, I would say, what's your prescription then, if it came to a normal person every day experiencing stress, and you had to prescribe them something, what is your go-to?
So the first thing I will underscore is the brain is a complex system. Every individual will have their own personal universe that they live in, and hence their perception of the cues will differ. So I don't tend to give people blanket one line or one single intervention as a prescription. So in Stress Proof, as you described earlier, I described seven pathways. And the bottom line is that if you're under chronic stress through reasons that are beyond your control, one of the ways in which you can protect yourself is by creating a roadblock at each of these seven pathways. And some people will be more prone to chronic stress through one of these pathways than others. So for instance, if you are, as an example, if you're a nurse who deals with, on a palliative care ward, let's just say, deals with a lot of emotional stress, emotional burden, and emotional burden in a way that reduces your controllability, then in your case, of course, adjusting circadian rhythm will work, will help to a degree. And of course, addressing insulin resistance will help. But in your case, the pathway you would have to focus on the most is your emotional reactivity. So, you know, I have a chapter on emotional reactivity in the book, and those are the pathways that I would perhaps suggest this person focuses on the most. So not reacting, focusing on, so you mentioned meditation. Meditation is going to be especially relevant in these situations. Controlling your emotional reactivity, controlling your baseline, improving your markers of recovery following an emotional response, increasing segments throughout your day where you can escape this burden of emotional stress. So these are the things I would advise someone in that situation to focus on. Now, if you're a night security guard who works night shifts day after day, and the rest of your life is completely fine, but you are noticing that very gradually your mood is not great, you're putting on weight, something's not right, you're not getting joy anymore, then your route to chronic stress is very likely a disrupted circadian rhythm. And again, I've got a chapter on that in the book. And in that case, yes, of course, doing meditation, eating well are all things that will help you. Eating well, when I say eating well, I mean eating according to what I describe, will help you. Reducing inflammation will help you. But in your case, you need to focus on really creating an antidote to the circadian rhythm disruptors that are coming your way. So you need to see your own situation, and you need to identify which of these seven routes is most relevant. Perhaps one is, perhaps they all are. Yeah. And if you can't do, because I've put in quite a few strategies, hundreds of strategies in there. So whatever is most relevant to you, do that, and it will go a long way. And as soon as you address the one main pathway, or one or two main pathways, since they all connect together, the others will also become readjusted, become improved. And of course, if you have all the time in the world, do all of them. So this would be my general advice. If I were to not know about someone's background at all, then of course I'd mention the seven things. We haven't spoken about circadian rhythm, but circadian rhythm is, for instance, and we also haven't spoken about gut bacteria, which is a very, very relevant part, an emerging part of the stress response. I mean, a paper came out, I think, possibly just today or very, very recently, on how giving students a particular lactobacillus, particular strain of bacteria, measurably improved the academic stress response. And this comes on the back of quite a few other studies that I've quoted on how your perception of stress and your physiological response to it can be altered by your gut bacteria. We haven't spoken about that, but gut bacteria, for instance, are influenced by your circadian rhythm. And your gut bacteria, in turn, influence your circadian rhythm. Gut bacteria also influence inflammation and insulin resistance. And insulin resistance and your insulin peaks feed back into cortisol and into circadian rhythm. So all of these seven pathways that I've described are tightly connected. And it's a question of knowing what your personality is, what environment you're working in, and where your likely sources of stress are, and then addressing those.
Wow, this is... I learned so much talking to you. This was like a crash course in stress, because no matter how much you think about stress, what I just learned throughout this was it's perceived stress that matters, and that comes from the brain. And also that there really isn't a one-stop shop for everybody. Everybody, you know, that's why I'm not so big on the meditation, because that might not be right for everybody. And it really depends on, it's very individualized. It's, you've really got to pinpoint where your stress is coming from and then put in the actions to mitigate that in the acute phase. And for me, it's more so the emotional or the mental stress. And I definitely will be downloading Tetris. But for those of you, for the people who haven't found your book yet, where is this book? Is it on Amazon? We're going to link it all below in the show notes.
Yes, it's so in the United States, of course, it's on Amazon. It's available from Barnes and Noble. In Australia, I forget the name of the
Dimmicks?
Bookstore, but it's there. Sorry, yeah. Say that again.
Yeah. Dimmicks?
Dimmicks, yeah. Yes, it's available yes. there. So it's available through most of the big bookstores and Amazon.
And we're also going to link your Twitter page where you and I connected first. So me too, thank you so much for being part of the Neuro Experience podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.